providers, consumers. The way he drew it, it came out a neat little diamond with a word at each corner. The magic diamond. Clark thought a minute about the spot in the middle, which is, of course, where he assumed any company he would create belonged. Say there was maybe one-third of $1.5 trillion a year of pure waste. Say he cut out half of that and kept the rest as profit. He'd still be bigger than Microsoft. And Microsoft was on its way to becoming the most highly valued company on the New York Stock Exchange. If he was going to create the most valuable company in America, the company would need a name. He might as well have written in Jim Clark Enterprises, for that is what it amounted to. Instead, he wrote Healthscape. Any other human being would have been tossed in an asylum for thinking such grandiose thoughts. Clark had invented Jim Clark, and so he was taken seriously. Chapter 7. Throwing Sand in Capitalist's Eyes. Not long after he drew the magic diamond with himself at the center of the U.S. healthcare industry, Clark drove up to Sand Hill Road to see the venture capitalists. The venture capitalists advertised themselves as the great financial risk-takers of the valley, but you could learn everything you needed to know about their attitudes towards risk simply by driving up Sand Hill Road. Sand Hill Road was where the venture capitalists clustered together for safety, like ducks in a park waiting for the breadcrumbs to fall. Each time Clark made this trip, the ducks came out of it worse than the time before. The price of the crumbs rose, and they had to quack louder for them. When Clark had gone to see the venture capitalists about Netscape, it was with the understanding that he would act as the CEO until the company was up and running. This time he proposed not only that he take home the lion's share of the stock in the new company, but that the venture capitalists do all of the actual work. Clark had no plans to spend even a day in the Healthscape offices. He had ceased to be a businessman and had become a conceptual artist. Having articulated the new thing, Clark intended to return to the important work of teaching his computer to sail his new boat. Amazingly, the question in his mind was not whether a venture capitalist would accept this deal, but which venture capitalist he would grace with his presence. The venture capitalists had learned a hard lesson from Netscape. Before Netscape went public, a lot of venture capitalists had thought John Doerr and his firm, Kleiner Perkins, had been mad to agree to Clark's terms. Clark had charged Doerr 3 times the going rate for startup capital. Doerr had cleared $500 million or so in 18 months, or 30 times his original investment, and become the most talked-about venture capitalist on Sand Hill Road. The other venture capitalists were forced to concede the point. The new higher price for concepts and the people who dreamed them up was obviously worth paying. Dick Kramlich from New Enterprise Associates, NEA, the Valley's biggest pile of venture money and healthcare expertise, made the strongest pitch to Clark. Clark still complained about the way Kramlich had joined forces with Ed McCracken to muscle him aside at Silicon Graphics, but Kramlich was one of those gentle souls who just wants everyone to get along and was, at least on the surface, willing to subordinate his ego to others. "If there is crow to eat and groveling to do," said one of his colleagues, "Dick is the first in line to do it." Kramlich had turned up at one of Netscape's meetings with investors immediately before the IPO and told Clark how happy he was for his success. This act of self-abasement, a formal acknowledgment that Clark was too important to ignore, encouraged Clark to rethink his opinion of Kramlich. He still hadn't forgiven Kramlich for siding with Ed McCracken, and he never would, but he was, let us say, touched by the gesture. As it happened, Clark had a motive for reconsidering his irritation with Kramlich. He was now even more irritated with John Doerr. Whenever Doerr's name came up, Clark's mouth went into full pucker mode. When Clark had offered Doerr the chance to invest in Netscape, Doerr had been rather down on his luck. Between 1991 and 1993, Doerr had persuaded a lot of people, himself included, that the future of the Valley was in pen computing. Pen computing was a version of the Palm Pilot, ahead of its time. Doerr had burned tens of millions of capital on a dramatic failure to stuff computers into ordinary people's pockets, called Go. After Go, Doerr seized on interactive television. He took to making futuristic speeches, the theme of which was that interactive television would transform the world. He'd give the same speech right through to the end of the decade, simply replacing interactive television with the Internet. Clark had rescued Doerr from that particular blind alley, and then helped him to cook up other new Internet companies. One of those companies was At Home. Clark and Doerr shared an obsession with Microsoft. Both felt that the Internet would be too big for Microsoft to ignore. They assumed further that a few years down the road, the Internet would enter people's homes through their television cables, which could transmit data much faster than phone lines. Ergo, Microsoft would seek to dominate the cable Internet industry. At Home was designed to secure the cable industry for Silicon Valley. The important work was in the concept, so far as Clark was concerned, and the concept for At Home had been at least as much his as it was Doar's. And yet Doar's firm, Kleiner Perkins, had denied Clark the chance to buy a piece of At Home, at least at first. Kleiner Perkins hewed to the old venture capital model, which relegated entrepreneurs like Clark to the sidelines of any business they did not explicitly create. They declined to pay Clark at his new conceptual artist rates. Clark responded by telling Doar that he planned to go elsewhere with his concepts. Now he had one, the magic diamond. Once again, he had put his name on a concept and was off and running down his long, dark tunnel. A few weeks after he saw Kramlich at the Netscape gathering, Clark drove up Sand Hill Road and paid a call on NEA, Kramlich's venture capital firm. Kramlich finally seemed to understand that the world had changed and that the engineer with the beautiful concept was its natural ruler. That was a big point in Kramlich's favor. Kramlich gathered his partners into the conference room. Clark drew the magic diamond, with Hellscape at the center of America's only $1 trillion industry, the world's single largest market, and announced he was going to fix the U.S. healthcare system. Of course, no one who actually understood the U.S. healthcare system would have dared to make such a grandiose statement. And of course, Clark knew he did not understand it, and knew also, or at least sensed, that his lack of understanding was a psychological advantage. No one who understood the U.S. healthcare industry would bother to try to fix it. Kramlich and his partners responded just as Clark assumed they should. They wanted a piece of the action. They asked him to come up and talk to them again, soon. The failure to land Netscape had already cost Kramlich $500 million. That failure was in part blamed on Alex Slutsky, the young Harvard Business School graduate who had been assigned to trail behind Clark after he quit Silicon Graphics. Slutsky had been forced to move on from NEA shortly after Netscape went public. "They fired Alex because he didn't land Jim," says another former NEA employee. "Fired in this case just means they made Alex's life so miserable that he left." To handle Clark this time around, Kramlich lined up two senior partners, Phil and Bill. Phil and Bill were NEA's healthcare specialists. Phil and Bill were also pretty much everything Clark hated about venture capitalists. Both were self-consciously professional men who knew how to dress down for meetings with engineers and how to dress up for meetings with Wall Street financiers, and never said anything in any of these meetings that surprised anyone. They were conventional people who assumed that conventions made the world go round, which, of course, they usually do. In any case, they didn't really believe in the possibility of change, and so did not bring the passion of revolutionaries to their work. As one of their NEA colleagues explained it, "Phil and Bill were totally unwilling to work nights and weekends to write a business plan, brainstorm, spend time with Jim during the off hours, etc." Phil and Bill, even more than Dick Kramlich, viewed Clark as a dangerously volatile, perhaps even mad, character who needed to be managed. Clark looked around Dick Kramlich's conference table filled with NEA partners and said he wanted nothing to do with Phil and Bill. He wanted Hugh. Hugh was Hugh Reinhoff, a young doctor with little business experience who had just quit one job at Johns Hopkins and taken another in NEA's Baltimore office. So far as Phil and Bill were concerned, Hugh was an interloper. So far as Clark was concerned, that was fine. Clark often preferred young, inexperienced people over older, more experienced ones. Even if they didn't quite know what they were doing, at least they hadn't learned the wrong things. They hadn't lost their passion. They hadn't become business bores. And so, in September 1995, at Clark's fierce insistence, Hugh took over where Alex Slutsky left off. He became Clark's personal minder on the sprint down the long, dark tunnel. "My job," Hugh later said, "was not to leave Jim's side, to make sure that NEA got a piece of whatever Jim created." Improbably, Clark had been catapulted to the top of the capitalist food chain. Once there, he insisted that the people who had spent their careers there act more like him. He expected the venture capitalists to join him in throwing money at the idea and letting his engineers work out the details. Up till then, the businesses funded by Silicon Valley venture capitalists may have been adventurous by the standards of American commerce, but the adventure was well planned. Now, the adventure was reckless. Clark was making it up as he went along. Deep in his intuitive soul, he thought business plans and business models and management structures were a waste of time. Time was the one commodity you could not waste if you wanted to make $1 billion from the Internet. Once he had identified the new thing, all he needed was some really smart, passionate engineers to chase after it and make it happen. After all, the idea was simple. Eliminate the paperwork, the waiting around, and the market illogic from the U.S. healthcare system by bringing all the people in that system together on a single network. The idea was not nearly as astonishing as Clark's audacity in putting it across to the venture capitalists. At the same time that he was telling them how to invest their money and plotting to take over the $1 trillion healthcare industry, Clark was working nearly full-time as a computer programmer. He took on the world's single largest market as a part-time job. When he woke up in the morning, he wrote code for his boat. When he went to bed at night, he stared at the ceiling and thought about the bugs in the boat's code. He communicated with the venture capitalists chiefly by email, which is to say that he rarely actually had to see them anymore. Probably a chapter could be written on the effect of email on the American business imagination. Within about 18 months, it had gone from being exotic to essential. Those businessmen who were uncomfortable with computers cheated and pretended to use email. Netscape CEO Jim Barksdale, for instance, did not actually fetch his own email, but had his secretary type it up for him. But all of the people with whom Clark dealt were now available at his fingertips, whatever whim might strike him at 3 in the morning. He had a lot of whims. Most of Clark's early missives betrayed his concern with finding people he liked to run Healthscape. He wanted to hire people he trusted rather than people the venture capitalists recommended. For instance, in late October, Clark wrote to Hugh Reinhoff concerning his old engineering buddy Tom Jermalak, now president of Silicon Graphics, saying,
"TJ could absolutely do the job of CEO of Healthscape, but I doubt he's interested because although he'd like to make more money, he's not risk-oriented. I also met with the best software manager at SDI, and he is interested. Keep this highly confidential because while he expressed interest in going, I don't want anyone else to get wind of this. October 24th, 1995.
Clark didn't want anyone else to get wind of this because it was a breach of his contract. The moment Netscape went public, it started getting resumes from Silicon Graphics' engineers. Already Clark had received letters from Ed McCracken's lawyers threatening to sue him if he recruited engineers from Silicon Graphics. The Valley's leading venture capitalists did not instantly adopt all of Clark's assumptions about work and life, but they entertained them, and they tended to let Clark have his way. Clark now possessed a new kind of power. He could go anywhere he wanted with his precious concepts, and if the venture capitalists did something he did not like, he would. Inevitably, the venture capitalists did something he did not like. Towards the end of October, Dick Kramlich invited Mark Perry, the vice chairman of Silicon Graphics and an Ed McCracken sympathizer, to become a partner at NEA. In theory, this should have been none of Clark's business. In practice, Clark now had a lot to say about what happened inside any venture capital firm that wanted his concepts. On October 31, 1995, Clark fired off an intemperate email to several NEA employees.
"Dick is nuts for getting Mark Perry as partner of NEA. Your firm went down a notch when I heard that. It calls into question Dick's judgment. Quite an insult to the rest of the partners. Sorry to be so blunt."
With that out of his system, he made some small attempt at conciliation.
"I do like Mark, but he is still vice chairman of SGI, which, when added to Dick's role there,"
Kramlich remained on the board of Silicon Graphics,
"makes me very uncomfortable that SGI will hear that I'm talking to TJ, and this would not be good. I intend to recruit heavily from SGI."
Then he gave up being sweet.
"Anyway, I think you'll probably have to co-invest with KP,
Kleiner Perkins,
and if I detect any problems with these guys hearing about my recruiting, I will move away from NEA pronto."
Breaking up was never all that hard to do for Clark. Email made it easier. As he was well aware, the whole point of Hugh shadowing him was to prevent him from drifting into the arms of other venture capitalists. Kramlich's nightmare was Clark wandering up the road to John Doerr at Kleiner Perkins, who simply by following Clark's lead was already being treated as the venture capitalist of the future. Clark's tiff with Doerr had given Kramlich his opening. Now Clark was saying that his new irritation with NEA exceeded whatever lingering resentment he felt towards Doerr. Inside NEA, the situation quickly went from bad to worse. One of NEA's partners, who called Clark a psychopath, took to pasting magazine photos of him on the office walls, with homemade captions that cast Dick Kramlich as the unfortunate father and Clark as the troubled son, in an Oedipal melodrama. Another partner complained regularly that Clark was mucking up their entire investment portfolio by persuading them of his latest ideas about the Internet, which he often himself abandoned. Half the firm was furious Kramlich had done a deal with the devil. The other half was furious the deal had not been fully consummated. And once it was clear they might lose control of Clark to John Doerr, all hell broke loose. Kramlich tried to pull Hugh Reinhoff off Clark and slide in, once again, the older and more established pair, Phil and Bill. Phil wrote Hugh instructing him to back away from Clark. Hugh wrote Phil and said he'd do so gladly. The trouble was that, whether or not Hugh knew it, Clark now was in control of Hugh. And Clark didn't like being told that he had to deal with Phil. He wanted Hugh, and, as was now abundantly clear, what Clark wanted, Clark got. He shot off another email that found its way to Dick Kramlich.
I'm really pissed at Phil's attitude. He is a fucking partner there. I'm not going to let NEA have as much of the deal because of his childish behavior. That is a fucked-up partnership with babies like him as general partners.
Within days, Clark had called a meeting with NEA that included John Doerr. Within weeks, he had agreed to split the equity into 11 parts, with he and Kleiner Perkins each taking 4 parts and NEA getting only 2. In mid-November 1995, Kleiner employee David Schnell, writing, "On behalf of NEA and Kleiner Perkins," sent Clark an email,
"Reviewing our discussion on your business model," saying, "Thanks for getting the NEA and KPCB groups together to share ideas. Like Netscape, we believe Healthscape should be built first by capturing all the plans, employees, and employers in enterprises, for example, corporations, universities, nonprofits, with services they demand now and will pay for. Establishing that beachhead then allows Healthscape to attack other opportunities. P.S. John Doerr is now predicting that you may be the only entrepreneur on the planet to found 3 ventures worth more than $1 billion.
Schnell was yet another medical doctor who had decided that he wanted to be a venture capitalist. He was now a Kleiner employee who had been told by his bosses that, if he wanted to make partner, he needed to prove himself. The boss's idea of how Schnell might prove himself was to become a captain of one of Jim Clark's ships. If Schnell went out with Jim Clark's imprimatur and came back with a few $100 million in profits, he could be a partner at Kleiner Perkins. Schnell, who knew perfectly well what it meant to be the captain of Jim Clark's ship, politely declined. In the end, he was given no choice, and he became, reluctantly, Healthscape's acting CEO. The sycophantic tone of his email to Clark suggested that Schnell, like every other venture capitalist, felt Clark needed to be managed. He sought to give Clark the feeling that he was in control of what might become the world's largest company without giving him actual control. As a result, it wasn't long before Clark found fault with Kleiner Perkins, or at least with David Schnell. Schnell, together with Hugh Reinhoff at NEA, kept trying to pin Clark down by offering up various business models and business plans for Healthscape. In early December, Clark wrote to both.
The problem I have with the way this discussion with KPNEA and me has been going is that it is more or less in the abstract. That is, we're cooking up a business plan without a management team. This may be the way some companies are formed, but I'm more interested in finding bright people with a passion to change the way things are.
Clark had required only about 6 weeks of very part-time work to sow strife inside Dick Kramlich's partnership. He required only a few weeks more to disrupt John Doerr's. A month after his first email to Clark, David Schnell sent another email to everyone but Clark, who was even slightly involved with Healthscape, to complain about
JC's behavior here.
David Schnell had new fears. The guy inside the venture capital firm who worked with Clark, he grumbled, was always the guy who got fired. He was more prescient than he knew. That was how it was now with Clark and the VCs who now sat on top of American capitalism, funding the many people newly engaged in the search for the new thing. Clark was at best ambivalent about young men in suits who had gone to business school and never run a real risk in their lives. He certainly was never going to let them have their way, unless their way happened to be his way. This raises an obvious question. Why did the world's most important venture capitalists put up with Clark? Surely it would have been easy enough for Kleiner Perkins or NEA to announce that they were backing someone else to do the same thing as Clark. Valley venture capitalists stole each other's ideas all the time. Right from the start, Clark put much less effort into his enterprise than they did, though even they did not know that he was spending most of his time computerizing a boat.
"I knew Jim was doing this on the side," Reinhoff said much later. "He had the big vision. The details fell to those in the company. I really didn't know what else he was doing. I assumed it was Netscape that took up most of his energy."
And yet, not once did anyone dare to suggest that Clark was not carrying his load, or that the business would be better off without him. That was the miracle of Jim Clark. By the end of 1995, he had created a money-making machine in which he was the least easily replaced part. The venture capitalists, the investment bankers, the CEOs, they were all fungible. If you were going to seize control of a $1 trillion industry, you needed a certain authority with the engineering class. In the fall of 1995, no one in the Valley had the same authority with the engineers as Clark. That aura was why every one of the emails sent from Kleiner and NEA to people who might come to work for Healthscape boasted right up front that the magic diamond was Jim Clark's idea. In late 1995, there was a new kind of faith that was in the engineering mind. Engineers believed that if Jim Clark said he was going to do something new, however outlandish his proposal, he would do it. And Clark responded to the faith by cooking up ever more outlandish new things to do. The software that was required to link the entire U.S. healthcare industry was not trivial to design. The land-grab logic of the Internet meant that it had to be thrown together about three times as fast as it should. To build a complicated piece of software so quickly, you needed engineers, and not just any engineers. You needed the smartest engineers. By late 1995, the smartest engineers in Silicon Valley had a lot of choice in how they spent their time. The Valley was booming. A lot of people were claiming to have stumbled upon a great new business opportunity. To attract the smartest engineers, you needed to persuade people you had the new thing. Clark figured that there were about three software cowboys who could pull off what he had in mind as quickly as it needed to be pulled off. All worked for Silicon Graphics. He knew them all and spoke to them all, and they were all more than a little interested in working for him. In the end, he decided that one more than the others had the passion to change the world. On Christmas Eve 1995, Clark's final choice arrived at Kleiner Perkins for his interview with David Schnell, which even Schnell knew was a formality. On Christmas Day, David Schnell wrote to Clark,
"I spent several hours yesterday with Pavin. I think he's great, and I believe he wants to join."
Chapter 8. The Great Brainquake of August 9th, 1995. Like a lot of software engineers in Silicon Valley, Pavin Nigam can recall where he was when he heard about Netscape's initial public offering, or at least he can figure it out. He was in India, he's sure of that. He couldn't have been in Kanpur, his hometown. Kanpur was a squalid, fly-specked, death-drenched city overrun by cows and pigs and chickens. When a person with Western standards of hygiene stepped off the train in Kanpur, his first thought was to get right back on. Even Pavin now found it repellent. More to the point, Kanpur did not receive American newspapers, and Pavin distinctly recalls reading the front page of USA Today. So he must have been in Delhi, which means he was in a hotel. So, in a Delhi hotel, he picked up the August 10th, 1995 edition of USA Today, and read that Netscape had risen from the offering price of $18 a share to a high of $174. By late 1995, Pavin's mental state was not good. In the short 15 years since he had come to America from India, he had risen to what he thought were fantastic heights in Silicon Valley. He had just finished 18 putatively spectacular months at Silicon Graphics, where he had been the boss of the most glamorous engineering project in the Valley, the creation of the world's first interactive television. He'd hired 50 of the smartest engineers ever assembled under one roof. He'd spent $300 million corporate research dollars. He'd had his name and his picture in the newspaper. Famous businessmen had told him that his work was important, and all he had to show for it was a black box that was supposed to sit on top of people's TVs, but was as hopelessly out of touch with the market as the kitchen computer. Not a single one was ever sold. That experience had pretty much shattered Pavin's faith in pure technical virtuosity, or what he called the religion of technology. Great technical success had proven to be a great commercial failure.
"Just a bunch of engineers solving problems," as Pavin put it derisively.
Anyway, by the time he left for India and a few weeks of serious self-examination in August 1995, Pavin suspected that Jim Clark was always right, except, of course, when he was wrong. And when Jim Clark was wrong, he wasn't around to suffer the consequences. The lesson Pavin extracted from the bitter experience was, watch what Jim Clark did, not what he said. Before he boarded the plane, Pavin called his stockbroker and left an order to buy Netscape at the opening. Reading USA Today in the Delhi hotel, he calculated that he must have bought at $50, the price of the first trades, and sold at $100, the price he'd instructed his stockbroker to sell. He never seriously believed that Netscape's share price would reach $100. It was, he said, the easiest money I ever made in my life. But even so, it was bittersweet. Netscape had gone to $174 a share. He'd left $74 a share on the table. With that and many other thoughts on his mind, Pavin returned to the squalor of Kanpur.
I remember sitting there in my parents' house for 2 weeks with all these cows running around me, he said. I remember that I decided right then, whatever I did next, it was going to be with the web.
Pavin had learned enough about American capitalism to know that where the stock market went, the opportunity followed. That thought was followed pretty quickly by a second thought.
I remember thinking that if I could find out whatever Jim Clark planned to do next, I would do that.
The Silicon Valley labor market was one of the many new joys in Jim Clark's new life. Having decided that the $1 trillion healthcare industry was the new thing, and in so deciding, having transformed it into the new thing, Clark needed to hire a lot of smart people quickly. There was no easier place to do that on the planet. Silicon Valley engineers had long treated the companies they worked for with less than the usual fidelity to the corporate cause. Their bosses, of course, disapproved of those who defected, and so there was a running debate about what was simply the proper workings of a free market, and what was an unseemly breach of loyalty. The steady stream of engineers out of Silicon Graphics and into Netscape just before Netscape went public prompted Ed McCracken's lawyers to write Clark nasty letters. With Healthscape, Clark figured he needed even bigger brains and planned to poach them from Silicon Graphics, only he couldn't be seen to do it. His solution to the problem was to sneak in and hire one fine software cowboy and let him be the Pied Piper. If he hired the right person, the rest would beg to follow, and Ed McCracken could do nothing to stop them. The moment of conception was, to Clark's way of thinking, the critical moment of any new enterprise. At that moment, it was important not merely to hire the people bent on changing the world, but to avoid hiring the people who are bent only on changing jobs.
"There are all sorts of guys who will show up because they can't think of anything else to do," he said. "Those are exactly the people you don't want. I have a strategy for dealing with these people. When they come by to apply for a job, I tell them, we're all confused here. We don't know what we're going to do yet. But when you find someone you want, I tell them, here's exactly what we're going to do, and it is going to be huge, and you are going to get very, very rich."
For engineering talent, Clark looked to Silicon Graphics. In particular, he had his sights on the Indian engineers who had taught him to write the code for his boat and then built the interactive television. Clark had a thing for Indians.
"The Indian outcasts of Silicon Valley," he usually called them. "My Indian hordes," in less sober moments.
He thought of the young Indian men who had taught him the tools he needed to program his sailboat as some of the sharpest technical minds he'd ever encountered.
"As a concentrated group," he said, "they were the most talented engineers in the valley, and they worked their butts off."
As it happened, the Indian education system had been built to find and to cultivate precisely those skills Clark and people like Clark valued most. Of course, that isn't how it was originally conceived. The Indian educational system was conceived by Nehru in reaction to the British colonial experience. Nehru believed that India was more likely to remain an independent country if it made itself technologically equal to its former rulers. To that end, he created a ruthlessly efficient mechanism for finding and exploiting Indian technical talent. It was called the Indian Institute of Technology. The IITs were created in the early 1960s with foreign aid. The first two, at Kharagpur and Madras, were funded by Germany. The third, in Bombay, by the USSR. The fourth, at Kanpur, by the United States. The fifth, at Delhi, by the UK. The IITs became the funnel through which young Indians who finished high in the national standardized test passed on their way into Nehru's game of catch-up ball. The force of their attraction was spectacular. It was as if a nation of 900 million people had set out to find the few among them most able to program a computer and leave nothing to chance. By the time Nehru finished engineering Indian society, every parent in the country wanted his son to become either a doctor or an engineer. By the early 1970s, hundreds of thousands of Indian 17-year-olds were sitting for the annual 2-day engineering exams. A few weeks after the exam, the results were posted in the newspapers. The 2,000 students with the highest scores won admission to the IITs and had their names printed in the newspaper. Imagine the thrill of gaining entrance to Harvard. Multiply it several times. That gives you some idea of the sense of destiny that accompanied admission to an IIT.
"If you could make it into an IIT, the rest of your life was guaranteed," said Pava Nigam. "If you don't make it into an IIT, there are no guarantees about anything, and I mean anything."
But the exam was just the beginning of India's search for its own technical aptitude. The 2,000 students who passed the test were further ranked according to their scores. Beginning at the top, they selected the schools and the departments they wished to enter. These schools and their departments had their own informal hierarchy. For instance, by the early 1980s, the most desirable place to study in the whole of India was the computer science department at IIT Kanpur, the school funded by the United States. The Kanpur computer science department had only 50 places. By the time the student who had placed 100th in the exam wandered in to make his choice, the places were already taken by others who had done better on the exam. Out of the 150,000 Indian high school students who took the national exam in 1978, Pavan Nigam finished 91st. He took one of the last places in computer science at Kanpur. He couldn't have known it at the time, but his success put him on a collision course with Jim Clark. A system designed to churn out engineers for a third-world economy would soon be used to its greatest effect in the quest for the new thing. The talent that the government had gone to such trouble to find and cultivate wound up being some of the most sought-after corporate employees on the planet. All these bright young men spoke English. They could quite easily pick up and go to America, which was paying the highest price for their talent, and in massive numbers, that is exactly what they did. Indian engineers flooded Silicon Valley in the 1980s and 1990s. By 1996, nearly half of the 55,000 temporary visas issued by the U.S. government to high-tech workers went to Indians. In early 1999, a Berkeley sociologist named Annalise Saxenian discovered that nearly half of all Silicon Valley companies were founded by Indian entrepreneurs. The definitive smell inside a Silicon Valley startup was of curry. So one day, when Jim Clark had finished writing his code for the boat, he picked up the phone and called Pavan Nigam and told him about his idea for making him rich. When Pavan asked for a business plan, Clark simply revealed the magic diamond, with Healthscape at the center. Pavan was at first very excited, then he was very nervous. Software engineers went hunting in packs. He couldn't do such a big project alone. Where would he find the engineers he needed to help him? Pavan often said that,
"The difference between a great software guy and an okay software guy is huge. A great software guy is worth 10 times an okay software guy."
Software wasn't like hardware. Software was more like art. Clark was thrusting a project on him that required the very best artists. True, a lot of those people worked with him at Silicon Graphics, but like Clark, Pava knew that Ed McCracken's lawyers would not put up with a systematic raid on the staff. And if he couldn't actively recruit from Silicon Graphics, where would he find the brilliant engineers he would need to succeed?
"You won't have to recruit," said Clark. "They'll follow you."
Clark's confidence finally swayed Pavan. Then he hung up. An hour later, Pavan's anxiety came storming back. After all, he was at that moment a very senior guy at Silicon Graphics, and Silicon Graphics was a very well-established corporation. It was a big risk for him to jump to running a startup. He knew exactly nothing about the U.S. healthcare system. He had never even been inside an American hospital or visited an American doctor. He wasn't even sure what his own health insurance covered. Pavan phoned Jim Clark back.
"I thought about it, and I don't think they'll follow me," he said.
Clark said,
"Pavan, just trust me on this one."
But how could Pavan trust anyone with a decision of such importance? Clark was already a billionaire. ITV had demonstrated Clark's ability to lead Pavan and a lot of other people down a blind alley and into a brick wall. What if Clark changed his mind again? What if Pavan left Silicon Graphics and announced that he'd planned to
fixed the American healthcare system, and no one showed up to help him. Where would he be then?
He'd be the 36-year-old Indian immigrant who had built a black box no one had bought, sitting alone in an office, while everyone he knew laughed at him behind his back. That's where he'd be. Fix the U.S. healthcare system. Right. Pavan knew well that it was possibly illegal and certainly immoral for him to recruit from Silicon Graphics, but surely he could pick one person and have a chat. There was one person above the rest who would ease considerably Pavan's anxiety, Kittu Kalari. Kittu was both the smartest engineer he had working for him and a trusted friend. Surely Pavan had a right to confide his discussion with Jim Clark to his friend. For a few years there, Kittu Kalari had been the chief target of Jim Clark's weird phone calls. Clark called him Kittu when the correct pronunciation was Kittu. Never mind. Whenever Clark was floating off the coast of Tahiti or Borneo and needed a bit of advice on the computer program he was writing for the yacht he could not afford, he called Kittu. Kittu could not understand why the chairman of a big American corporation would spend his time writing computer code. He understood very well, however, why a man writing computer code would call him for help. Kittu was another fine example of the power of Indian society to ferret out its technical talent and catapult it in the direction of people like Clark, who knew how to use it.
"There are these definite moments in my life," Kittu said, "when I know that things changed and I became an engineer."
The first such moment was when his cousin from Bombay came one summer to visit his family in Hyderabad. Kittu was in the sixth grade, and his cousin was a pretty young woman.
"She described this guy she had fallen in love with," said Kittu. "She was completely in love with him because he was so smart. She talked about how she loved his brain. He went to an Indian Institute of Technology. That was the first time I ever heard of an IIT. She spoke to me about him for 2 straight hours. I was captivated. Totally. I mean, what she was describing was a complete geek. She talked about how he had these 12-inch spectacles and so on and so forth. He sounded like a pretty grotesque-looking guy when you thought about it. But she kept saying how brilliant he was. And he's all she talked about. And I fell in love with the image my cousin had of Mokun Thapa. I wanted to be like Mokun Thapa."
One evening the next year, when Kittu was in the seventh grade, he fought with his father. About what, he does not recall. But he had gone off to a corner of the house and curled up to sleep.
"Then my father comes over and is being very friendly. He's smiling. And I say, 'What the fuck is wrong with this guy? An hour ago he was being an asshole.' And he says, 'Svarup,' that was what I was called then, 'the principal just called and said they want to take your picture for the newspaper.'"
In the general tests administered to Indian seventh graders, Kittu had come first in his region. His region contained 80 million people.
"It was one of those moments," said Kittu, "when you say, 'Whoa, I knew I was good, but I didn't know I was this good.' After that, it became a complete obsession for me. I was going to go to an IIT. My dad would come into my room at 3 in the morning, and I'd be studying. He would say, 'Svarup, you must go to sleep, you know.'"
Kittu, like Pavan, left India the minute he graduated from his IIT. After the requisite 2 years inside some American graduate school, which the Indians treated as a way station en route to Silicon Valley, Kittu had landed his job at Silicon Graphics. Not long after that, he'd met Clark. And not long after that, he found himself a kind of professional observer of Clark's quest for the new thing. Jim Clark's mind was Kittu's hobby. Kittu was fascinated that such a technically minded person could be so happy groping blindly towards big piles of money.
"Jim Clark has a clarity of vision that is prompted by the purest form of greed," said Kittu. "Nothing clouds it."
Like the other young programmers in the ITV department, Kittu could have had himself a job at Netscape the day the company was founded, simply by turning up at the front door.
"I knew that I was making a mistake by not joining Jim at Netscape," he said. "So many times Jim has said, 'I told you so.' And I assumed he would say, 'I told you so' again. But I didn't know how loudly he would say, 'I told you so.'"
His failure to join Netscape was the biggest financial mistake Kittu hoped he would ever make. In December 1995, he remained a Silicon Graphics employee earning a salary of $80,000. Had he followed Clark into Netscape, he would have been worth $20 million. Like Pavan Nigam, like pretty much every engineer at Silicon Graphics, Kittu saw a certain injustice in this. He viewed the computer engineers at Netscape as ever so slightly second-rate.
Certainly, the best and the brightest had not left Silicon Graphics to join Clark.
Technically, the Netscape browser was not much of an accomplishment at all, Kittu said. It did not belong on the same page with what he and Pavan and the others had achieved in Orlando.
Kittu could rattle off all the technologies brought together to create the world's first interactive television. 3D graphics, 2D graphics, ATM, frequency modulation, IMP1, MPEG-2, switching, infrared, a blizzard of baffling terms that leaves the outsider with the clear opinion he does not want to know any more than he needs to.
We got all wrapped up in the technology, Kittu said. We all thought, damn it, this technology is so cool. It must bring so much value to someone.
Which puts a fine point on a painful truth. The purpose of that technology was to make money. The higher purpose of the interactive television was to facilitate the stupor of the guy on the couch with the beer in one hand and the remote control in the other, which is to say that it had no higher purpose. Its lack of any higher purpose made its ultimate failure even more absurd.
ITV was, from a technical standpoint, as challenging as putting a man on the moon, said Kittu, and in the end, it was one great academic exercise, a waste of fucking time.
Netscape, on the other hand, was clearly not a waste of time.
The trick to Netscape was markets, said Kittu. Being at the right place at the right time, and that was all Jim Clark. If Jim Clark had not been there, Mark Andreessen and his friends would still be working for their PhDs at the University of Illinois.
Thanks to Jim Clark, the B team had got rich, while the A team stayed middle class, at least in Kittu's view. Some engineers, especially the older ones, passed this off to the different risk profile of engineers who created new companies. The implication was that really brilliant engineers like Pavan and Kittu did not have the taste for risk required to take a flying leap into one of Jim Clark's fantasies. Only now, they did. Clark was on to something when he went looking for Indians. It wasn't just that half his work had been done for him by the Indian government. It wasn't just that next to the sifting mechanism through which Pavan and Kittu had passed, the Harvard admissions department was a kind, forgiving place. It was that any person with the brains to get into the IITs and the gumption to get himself to the United States was capable of all manner of miracles. The Indian engineers had the lust for the kill that Clark loved. They were ferociously, recklessly competitive. Pavan and Kittu had finished in the top 0.01% on the test taken by bright young Indians, who probably already were in the top 0.01% on the national brain power scale. Yet, about twice a week, Pavan found a way to remind Kittu that he had finished 250 places behind him. To Kittu, the suggestion that he was too smart to take risk was
total bullshit.
In the first place, how much risk was there in working for a Silicon Valley startup? The worst thing that happened is that the startup failed and you went back to your old job and your $80,000 a year. Silicon Graphics or any other big company would have hired them back the instant they applied. In the second place, his life had been nothing but risk. The risk of growing up in a third world hellhole. The risk that he wouldn't get into a decent school that might catapult him out of the hellhole. The risk that he wouldn't find work in the United States. The risk that ITV, the highest profile engineering project in Silicon Valley, would flop. So far as Kittu was concerned, he'd lived his life on a high wire, without a safety net. Watching the B team of computer science whooping it up down the road after the Netscape public offering enraged him.
I'll tell you what I knew on the day Netscape went public, he said. I knew two things. I knew my next company would be a startup, and I knew that anything smaller than Netscape was unacceptable.
That day in December 1995, after Jim Clark showed him the magic diamond, with Healthscape at the center, Pavan went back to his job at Silicon Graphics. He asked Kittu to take a walk. The two of them spent several hours walking along the manicured lawns of Shoreline Boulevard, down by the marshy reaches of the bay, where they were less likely to be seen. Pavan told Kittu about the magic diamond. Kittu had only one clear thought about it.
No freaking way I was going to miss this one.
Of course, Pavan was not supposed to tell anyone about anything. When, that afternoon, he confessed to Clark that he'd spoken privately to Kittu, he also confessed his new problem. Tom Jermalak, TJ, the CEO of Silicon Graphics, had come to him and asked him to promise he would not steal any Silicon Graphics employees. TJ had himself just decided not to jump to Clark's new venture, and so, strictly speaking, Pavan could not recruit Kittu without breaking his promise. But there was nothing other than the fear of Ed McCracken's lawyers to prevent Clark from calling Kittu on Pavin's behalf, just to get things rolling. And so Clark did. And so once again, Kittu found himself the surprising recipient of a call from Jim Clark. Clark asked Kittu to stop by his house as soon as possible. Kittu stopped by the next day. He'd already made up his mind, the instant Pavin told him about the diamond. So far as he was concerned, all that was left was to negotiate the number of stock options he would receive. Plus, he was thrilled by the invitation to visit Clark at his home.
"But you know something?" he said. "I was not nervous at all. I could have gone to work anywhere. The fact that Jim Clark wanted me was enough. There's no way you can't follow Jim Clark."
Like Pavin, Kittu had absorbed the essential lesson of interactive television. Do what Clark did, not what he said to do. Kittu rolled into Clark's blonde pebble driveway and gazed up at the big house with the man-made hill at the back, and the cardboard boxes in the guest bedroom, and the old tuba beside them. There were about 6 shiny sports cars in the driveway. It could have passed for a small dealership. Clark ambled out of the house to greet him. He had his easy manner on. Clark was fond of saying that,
"There's nothing that gets you interested in money like having some of it."
Now that he had $1 billion, his life had become a great deal more financial. He truly loved money. Money truly loved him, and he wanted all the people he liked to be a part of the new relationship. He had just himself reached the point where he associated the word dollars not with millions, but billions. He wanted to help Kittu over his old habit of thinking thousands and into the new one of thinking millions. Soon enough, he was telling Kittu his favorite parable of missed opportunity. He had bought his house with the blonde pebble drive right after Silicon Graphics went public back in 1986. To pay for the house, he had sold 1 million shares of Silicon Graphics stock at $3 a share. The stock was now at $30 a share.
"You see that house?" Clark said to Kittu, making the obvious calculation. "That's my $30 million house."
Kittu didn't miss a beat. He turned around and pointed to his dusty Toyota and said,
"Jim, you see that car? I sold 2,000 shares of Silicon Graphics at $10 a share to buy that car. So that's my $60,000 Toyota Camry."
That day, Kittu returned to SGI to give notice. He was willing to stick around a few weeks and help his managers smooth the transition, but already his managers were in a state of high paranoia. People had heard that Jim Clark had a new startup, and that he had spoken about it to Pavin. Kittu's manager accused him of plotting to steal other engineers.
"And so," said Kittu, "I just said, fuck you, I resign."
Pavin Nigam resigned from Silicon Graphics on a Friday afternoon in February 1996. He had no idea who might join him aside from Kittu. He still suspected that no one would join, and that he would become a Silicon Valley laughingstock. So far as he knew, the only people who knew what he was up to were him, Kittu, Clark, and a few of Clark's venture capitalists. When he arrived home that evening, he found that several dozen people had faxed their resumes to his home machine. On Saturday morning, his phone began to ring. It never stopped. The first callers were engineers Pavin knew from Silicon Graphics. Within a few hours, the callers were complete strangers, who worked for companies Pavin had never heard of. By late afternoon, the calls were coming thick and fast. The moment Pavin ended one conversation, the phone rang and he started all over again. All the callers wanted one thing, a job with Pavin's new company. Soon enough, it was clear to Pavin that he was in a buyer's market for engineering talent. He only needed a dozen or so extraordinarily talented people to get the company off the ground. Once he realized how many people wanted to work for him, his manner became noticeably more gruff. When he'd pick up the phone, he wouldn't even bother to say hello. He'd say,
"Why are you calling me? What can you do for me?"
By Sunday morning, the engineers who had been unable to get through to Pavin on the phone started turning up at his front door. By Monday morning, more than 300 engineers had faxed resumes to his home machine, and countless others had phoned to apply for a job with Healthscape. And none of them had the faintest idea what Healthscape was. From this initial group of 300, a far bigger group stormed the gates later. Pavin culled his favorite Silicon Graphics engineers. After Kittu, he picked Shankar. After Shankar, he picked Motasim. After Motasim, he selected Flavio. After Flavio, he picked... well, you get the idea. Soon he had 10 of the smartest engineers he knew, all of whom had built the world's first interactive television. Two were Italian. Most of the rest were Indian. Pavan and Kittu and the others assembled on February 19, 1996, in a dinky office in downtown Palo Alto. It was a year or so after Hillary Clinton finally abandoned her hope of reforming the U.S. healthcare industry from the White House. Six Indians, two Italians, a Japanese, and a Belgian were going to do it from Northern California. Of course, none had the first clue what it was they were meant to be doing.
"It was very, very fuzzy," said Motassim Najib. "We didn't have a single line of code. We had nothing, really. HMO, PPO, all these names."
"I was asking for a business plan," recalled Shankar Srinivasan. "And there wasn't one. Pavan's notion in general was just to get enough bright people and throw them at the problem and something good will come out of it." As Kittu put it, no one knew a fucking thing about healthcare.
The thought clearly pleased him. On February 19, 1996, the 10 young engineers came to work. On February 20th, they flew to Boston to meet with Blue Cross Blue Shield. Most of them had never heard of Blue Cross Blue Shield. Here's how Shankar Srinivasan recalled his bizarre first brush with a tiny appendage of the U.S. healthcare industry.
"The first day was for them to tell us what they did and what they needed. The second day was for us to tell them what we were going to build. In between the first day and the second day, we had to figure that out. We sat up all night reading all this literature about healthcare. We asked, what is the problem we are going to solve here? All we had was Jim Clark's concept."
Pavan's engineers had no experience and no knowledge, but they had arrogance, ambition, and a blissful ignorance of the magnitude of what they were aiming to achieve. They had something else, too, the faith that they could impose technology on others. In short, they behaved as people always have at the cutting edge of capitalism, with the conviction that they could remake the world in their image. They worked mad hours. Many of them sent their families back to India. One morning at 8, Clark showed up on his motorcycle to have a look around. He noticed Panos, a Greek engineer, tucked behind his computer workstation. He said,
"You're here early."
Panos looked up and said,
"I never left,"
and went back to work.
"The passion, the fire was there," said Kittu. "There was a feeling that we were about to change the world. And we all now knew that was how you made money, by changing the world."
Theirs was a sunny aggression, propelled by Clark's will, his money, and his expectations. Any hope Pavan harbored that he might be permitted to fail quietly was quickly dispelled by a rearguard action of Clark's with the journalists who covered Silicon Valley. Although Pavan knew that Clark spent a surprising amount of his time on the phone with business journalists, he thought they'd agreed that for the first 6 months, until they had something to show people, they wouldn't talk to the press. A couple of days after that conversation, Pavan sat on the company toilet skimming the Wall Street Journal or USA Today or some other newspaper and saw a short article that began, "Jim Clark, founder of Silicon Graphics and Netscape, announced today that he plans to remake the U.S. healthcare industry." The more interesting truth was that 10 engineers in a small office in Palo Alto intended to remake the U.S. healthcare industry, with a bit of guidance from a doctor who had only agreed to be their CEO because he wanted to make partner at Kleiner Perkins, and an older man who was interested mainly in writing the code to computerize a yacht. And none of the engineers was a citizen of the United States. Stuart Leeroff was a short, bearded American man with a big, clean-shaven manner. Stuart was open, relaxed, friendly, large-spirited, and eager to be a part of the new thing. He had joined Silicon Graphics back in 1990 and gone to work building interactive television in April 1995, after the Orlando trials, but before the technology was unveiled in Japan. Several times, Pavan hinted to Stuart that he thought Stuart was a cut above the average member of his team. Like a lot of other people, Stuart had been converted to entrepreneurship by the Netscape IPO.
"That was the defining moment in all of our lives. Ah, shit, why didn't I do that?" he said. "Every one of us had it."
And so when Stuart saw a certain change come over Pavan, he asked Pavan if he had plans to leave Silicon Graphics and start a new company. Pavan became agitated and told Stuart,
"I can't approach you about it, but there is nothing to stop you from calling me. Do you understand what I am telling you?"
Stuart said he understood, and he did. The day Pavan announced his resignation, Stuart faxed over a letter to Pavan's house. It sat in the stack along with the 300 other faxes Pavan didn't read. A few days later, Stuart called Pavan and asked to talk. Pavan told him to wait 2 weeks and call back. Stuart waited 2 weeks and called again. Pavan failed to return his call. Stuart waited some more and then became irritated.
"I called every day and I couldn't reach him," he said. "I left message after message. Now I'm getting bitchy. Finally, I just said, 'I'm going down there.'"
Stuart found out that Pavan had rented offices in downtown Palo Alto and drove over.
"I walk in, and there are all these people I know. There's Motasim, there's Kittu and Shankar."
10 engineers were crammed into a bit less than 2,000 square feet, beavering away on some mysterious new project.
"I see Pavan," Stuart said, "and he says he never even saw my letter. He had so many letters."
When Stuart asked Pavan what the hell he was up to, Pavan drew a picture of the magic diamond. All the engineers loved the magic diamond, which Stuart recalls as a picture with Jim Clark at the center of 15% of the U.S. economy. It was like one of those cave paintings at Altamira, used by the hunter to secure his prey in advance, simply by depicting it on the wall. The engineers were hexing their prey. Anyway, once he caught the drift, Stuart was even more eager to be a part of the new company. He asked Pavan for a job.
"And Pavan says, 'I want to know what you're going to do for me.'"
At which point Stuart did a kind of double take. "Pavan, it's me, Stuart."
"In the end, I just sort of made something up."
Stuart knew that Pavan was an engineer's engineer. The most gifted people wanted to work for Pavan because he didn't waste time on the details.
"He focuses on engineering the design of the product," Stuart said. "He says screw the details for the moment. It's aggressive, but it's not stupid."
Stuart realized Pavan wasn't thinking about how to test the product, how to record the work.
"He assumed other people would take care of that stuff. I said I was other people, and he said it sounded good."
And then Pavan, busy trying to make himself an expert on the U.S. healthcare system, promptly forgot.
"So, 2 days later," recalled Stuart, "I'd drive up there again and ambushed Pavan. We went over to a coffee shop and in a few minutes figured out my salary and stock options. That's how I got my job at Healthscape."
It wasn't quite as simple as that. Pavan explained to Stuart that the usual American standards of diligence no longer applied. To work for Healthscape meant more or less abandoning his private life. Stuart took the job anyway. As he wrote to me later,
"The potential for making a lot of money was always there, implicitly, but when Pavan and Jim negotiated my compensation, the only explicit articulation of it was a 35% pay cut. The rest was funny money, in the way of stock options, and I had absolutely no frame of reference to base the value of these options. So my wife and I made the decision to quit SGI and join Healthscape based on my belief that Pavan Nigam, Jim Clark, and Kleiner Perkins were going to do something great, and I was just going to be a part of it. She asked me how much I could make, and I remember saying something about never having to work again. I remember telling someone, rationalizing why I had just quit SGI, 'Never in my life will I find all of these stars lined up at the same time. Pavan, Clark, Kleiner Perkins. The diamond with the H in the middle.'"
Stuart Leeroff was the 11th person and the 10th engineer, and the first full-blooded American to come to work for the new company. He joined at the end of February 1996. He was given a desk in the canteen bordered by the refrigerator, the sink, and the fax machine. He worked 120 hours a week, so many hours that the notion of work and home was absurd. Life was work, or at least being in the office.
Pavan, in his inimitable wisdom, grabbed a date out of the air and said, "We can deliver a product on October 1, 1996. And no one had a clue what the product was. All we knew is that it had to be a really huge piece of software so that it would look right in the middle of this huge diamond.
In spite of the obvious stress that came with his new situation, Stuart was delighted.
"It was 3 a.m., he recalled. I'm sitting there drinking espresso, listening to music, and writing up some notes about the software, and I could never explain this to anyone, not even my wife. I was so happy. I just laughed to myself."
That's how they all felt that first 9 months, as they rushed to complete their first piece of software for Blue Cross Blue Shield. They felt they were doing something important. Blue Cross Blue Shield was just the initial foray. Soon they would sit in the middle of the magic diamond. Other engineers begged to join them. Journalists came from afar to interview them. Jim Clark rode into their lobby on his motorcycle. Before long, Fortune magazine was ready to go to press with the first article on the company, before Healthscape was even really a company. Just then, the engineers learned that some enterprising person on the heels of Netscape had bought the rights to all sorts of names ending with Scape, including Healthscape, and wanted a fortune for its use. The engineers already had their logo, a big blue sign with Health in the middle. So they sat around thinking up names starting with Health. Health Now, Health-O, Healthathon. In the end, Healthscape became Healthion, and they were on their way. In short, Clark's latest little act of nerve triggered such a violent wave of talent and money to come washing his way that within a few months, a lot of serious people were saying things like, "Healthcare's the biggest market, but Jim Clark already controls that." But by then, Clark was fully aware that all he had to do was to announce to a few journalists that he intended to insert himself in the middle of the world's largest industry, and all sorts of serious people were off and running down his long, dark tunnel. That's where his job ended, so far as Clark was concerned. After he'd drawn his little diagram of the world's largest market with himself in the middle, he was finished. Other people could take care of the messy details of turning Healthion into a giant corporation. That's what he always said just after he had disgorged the new thing, and the new thing became simply the new thing. He was not finished, however. The one hard rule in Jim Clark's life was that he must always pursue the new thing. Three multi-billion-dollar companies was not enough for one lifetime. Once, when I'd asked him how he planned to convert his wealth to leisure, he said,
"You got to figure out something that is out of the path of Microsoft. You can forget building a big software business. If it is going to be big, and it is software, then it will be controlled by Microsoft."
Another morning he went off on an old-fashioned tear, the point of which was that Healthscape would prove that he had nothing more to prove.
"They can say that Silicon Graphics and Netscape was just luck, but when I do it again, and Healthion will do it, they can't say it was just luck," he said. "I don't have to do it again."
Not long after that, he said,
"But it would be something to do a fourth, wouldn't it?"
Well before Healthion became a success, he was groping. He programmed his boat, and he groped. Each time was harder than the time before, because each new idea had to be bigger than the one before. Netscape had been bigger than Silicon Graphics. Healthion, he felt sure, would be even bigger than Netscape. What was bigger than Healthion?
"I could always make $50 million, he explained to me once. "But who needs that?"
He didn't have time to create companies that were worth only $50 million. $50 million didn't count. Hell, his boat had cost $50 million when you added in the tax bill. When he groped big. He was a multi-billion-dollar corporation, perpetually waiting to happen. He was also a rare case of a man with the Chinese curse. He had gotten what he wished for. He was treated better and paid more than anyone else in the valley. He owned three times more shares in anything he dreamed up than anyone else, and other people did most of the work. And now, this was the curse, he couldn't stop. Even if he wanted to, which occasionally he claimed he did, he couldn't stop trying to force the hand of the future. He was doomed to be forever searching for the new thing. If nothing else, he now had an audience to play to. It was as if he had sold 10,000 tickets to a one-man show and now found himself standing on a stage, wondering how to keep the people in their seats. Venture capitalists lingered in Clark's life like Labrador retrievers.